We are studying the life of Joseph, the Joseph epic, and today we are in Genesis chapter 39, verses 7 through 20, and this is one of the most famous incidences in the life of Joseph, his resistance to temptation, Potiphar's wife. Let me give you a couple of texts that we will refer to that will add and supplement the richness of this study, and particularly the words that are used in our text. The first is Proverbs chapter 7. You'd set a tab there, and the chapter over Proverbs chapter 6. Those two chapters we'll be taking a look at. When we began the Joseph epic, I quoted Thomas Scott, the Puritan, and I try to use this quotation as a template to lay over Joseph's life. And here is that quotation again. Scott wrote hundreds and hundreds of years ago for our benefit, "The believer's progress must be gradual. His faith and graces must be proved, his pride subdued, before he can properly endure any kind of prosperity. For these purposes, the Lord often employs the perverseness of his brethren, often without knowledge or contrary to their intentions. So the believer's wisdom consists in this: waiting quietly and patiently under injuries, and leaving to God to plead his cause." Now, those opening words, "the believer's progress must be gradual," and we observed in our study together last week the first six verses of the 39th chapter, and discussing them in our introduction, which occurred prior to that, it covered an 11-year span of Joseph's life. He comes to Egypt, not knowing the language, the customs, and it took that 11 years before the full zenith of his ability to prosper became so well known among everyone, including Potiphar. And now the second stanza of the quotation of Scott's. He says, "His faith and his graces must be proved true." Joseph, through labor in that 11 years, has been tested time and again. And now our text this morning, he will be tested again. And in a different way, Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife is really the temptress of Proverbs chapter 7. If you'll look over at Proverbs 7, I count her one and the same with this woman three ways. First, notice Proverbs chapter 7 and verse 15. Her boldness. She is the aggressor. She says, "I came, I looked, and found." She appears to us here in verse 15 like the hungry lion out seeking what it can to devour. Second, she sets her trap. Notice when her husband is not at home. Verse 19. And that, again, matches Potiphar's wife. And third, verse 21, she uses persuasive words. And that's exactly what takes place in our account as she repeats day after day talking to Joseph. When my son was in his early and formative years, I often would refer to the life of Joseph and David and Abraham and others to give him some instruction. And when it came to Joseph, I tried to go to the tip of the spear for his life, and I would say, regarding this particular encounter, here's the question that you always want to ask yourself. Do I want her, or do I want Egypt, which God has for me in the future? See, the way of God's blessing and ultimate provision, the Joseph epic tells us it occurs in endurance and patience and holiness, righteousness. And without holiness, says the author to the epistle to the Hebrews, no one will see the Lord. Now, we begin our exposition this morning with the latter part of verse 6. Joseph was well built and handsome. In other words, he is cursed with good looks. I say cursed because attractiveness, just like money, just like power or fame, draws a crowd, and often the wrong kind of people surround you. And that makes life and its burdens far more difficult when you're trying to serve the Lord. Observe the words, well-built and handsome. A unique male description, says one commentator. These words are a setup for the temptress herself. Verse 7, observe that she is left nameless. That's because she could be an anybody. She's an Egyptian aristocrat. But now think of the irony. She is a slave to her own passions, seeking her own household slave. Now, here is a Genesis verb that is so important in understanding the lives of the patriarchs. It is used in the translated in the NIV as take notice of. But literally the verb is, she lifted up her eyes. Now that is a rich verb. We encounter it for the first time in Genesis in chapter 13 and verse 10. And you don't even need to turn there, because if you're familiar with the stories of Genesis, you remember this verb. And here it is. Lot lifted up his eyes, and he saw the well-watered plain. You see, the Jordan was well-watered, like the garden of the Lord in the fertile Nile of Egypt. So the verb is used in conjunction with what is attractive or appealing to the senses. And it's also used later on in Genesis chapter 24 in verse 64, where Rebekah, and the NIV translates it, looked up, literally, lifted up her eyes, and saw for the first time her husband Isaac. And there she sees him. She's been traveling with Abraham's servant for an extended period of time, and now she, for the first time, sets her eyes on her husband. So the verb not only indicates what is appealing to the senses, but also gives us an idea of anticipation. The phrase, verse 7, come to bed with me, is really in the original language only two words, and is never used anywhere in regards to marriage. Let's consider the timing of the words. They occur after his promotion, after he's proven himself to be valuable, after accomplishments. And all the time we receive our promotions and our rewards, we expect at least some sort of payoff. And so it comes at the precise time. It adds to the temptation. It makes it more acute. Verse 8, the but is a contrast. The contrast is his lengthy response to her only two words. The Bible teaches us that the faithful person will be given the words at the right time, in the right crisis or the right situation. And here we have a very spontaneous but lengthy response, well thought out and argued by Joseph. Look what he says. With me in charge, there are four features of his response. Let's note them carefully. The first is the word charge, meaning it'd be a violation of his trust that had been given to him. Look at those words at the end of verse 8, entrusted to my care. In other words, I'm the type of person you can trust your wife and your wallet to. Second, verse 9, no one is greater in this house than I am, meaning he accepted his promotion with thanksgiving and gratitude, not as something earned or deserved that we see often with our petulant athletes. Third, he sees things as they really are. He's not fantasizing here and fulfilling his own personal ego. Observe in verse 9, he calls Potiphar his master and reminds her that she is his wife. And finally, fourth, he asks the big question. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? God is Joseph's standard. It is his personal measuring stick, the plumb line, if you will. Not how it feels, not what others think, but God, invisible and real. I don't know the content of Joseph's theological knowledge, but it's obvious here that we can make some real application. Whatever his knowledge was, it held him accountable to his God. And gentlemen and ladies, it affected his employment. What he did on the job, how he behaved. And secondly, it affected his social discourse because of how he talked, how he behaved, how he interacted. That we can see from his response. So again, let's remind ourselves of the four things. He won't violate his trust. He will not singe his conscience. Second, he accepted his promotions with thanksgiving, and he offers thanks to God in all things. Third, he sees reality, not some fantasy to make himself different or be different. Life is just what it is for him. And finally, fourth, Joseph kept the reality of God at the center of his soul, someone he was ultimately accountable to, no matter whether you could see him or not. Verse 10, observe the enemy doesn't lose to just slither away, never to return again. The text says, she spoke to Joseph day after day. The great Samson was worn down by a woman, and as a result, he ended up a blind mule going around in a circle. That's what he did. When Israel went to Kadesh Barnea and fail by faith, God disciplined that generation. And what did He do with them? He sent them off on a 40-year merry-go-round in the wilderness, one big circle after another, going nowhere. That's Samson, and that's Israel. Our man, Joseph, isn't going in a circle. He's moving on. He's going to go to prison. And that is God's will for his life. Verse 11. One day he went into the house to attend his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. Now the term one day is a transition word. We move from specific generalizations about the behavior of Potiphar's wife and Joseph's behavior to one specific day. Verse 11. The phrase attended to his duties explains it was just an ordinary day for Joseph, being faithful to his master. But notice we will find there are no servants around. Perhaps she was sure that there would be no servants around. And that would be smart on her part, because if she got caught, then they would own her. Verse 12. She caught him by the cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." Two words. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. This verb to catch in the Old Testament is always used of a very violent act. A man forces himself physically upon a woman. But here the situation is reversed. The woman's attack is now upon the man. But her attack, interestingly, is not physical, but it is with speech. Seductive speech. And that's what makes this woman, and the woman illustrated for us in Proverbs chapter 6, so tied together. Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 20, a warning against adultery. Wisdom, says the wise man, will keep you, verse 24, from the immoral woman. And from her smooth tongue. And what would we expect from this book of consequences? Well, here it is. Verse 31. If he is, and here is our verb from Genesis 39. Caught. Potiphar's wife makes sure that the other servants aren't around, so she can catch Joseph. And so she dismisses the servants so that she can't be caught. She catches him, dismisses the servants so she can't be caught. Just like the immoral woman in the Proverbs, Potiphar's wife is the aggressor. And observe Joseph's response. Now it's different. He doesn't speak. He runs. Probably because when confronted, he recognized that he had placed himself completely under her power. There were no witnesses around. He had been set up. And the verb here, ran out, really literally means to run outside. And so here's the spiritual lesson from Joseph. Don't seek to carry on a theological discourse with temptation. That's what the woman did in the garden. Let's carry on a theological dialogue about fruit and good and evil and trees. That was the woman's mistake. But Joseph, he runs. And so, 2 Timothy 2:22, flee the evil desires of the youth. Verse 13, in her hand is his cloak. Joseph stole. When preaching on this text, said he conceded nothing but a garment to the dark empire. The word cloak that is used here is the same word that's used of garments in Genesis chapter 38, verses 14 and 19, in conjunction with Tamar's disguise to Judah. In chapter 37, in verse 33, Joseph's brothers used this very word, garments, to be deceptive with their father. Look, we see this robe. It's covered with blood. Examine it. Is this not your son's robe? And now here, Potiphar's wife will use this same word, garment, to lie to her husband. Verse 14, she only utters two words on two separate occasions. But now, to do Joseph in, she's going to have a lot of dialogue. She calls her household servants. Now, up to this point, what do we know of her interaction with servants? Well, we know that she has used them to exploit. That's exactly what she was doing with Joseph. But now I want you to observe, verse 14, she's going to seek to identify with them. Look, she said, this Hebrew, in other words, not one of us, he came, she says, to make sport of us, literally to mock us. Now that word to mock is found in Genesis chapter 19 and verse 14, where the men of Sodom that were pledged to marry Lot's daughters, and Lot went to them and appealed to them and said, hurry, get out of this place because the Lord's about to destroy the city. And the sons-in-law thought that he was just, and here's your word, mocking them. It's the thought of not taking something seriously. Thus, Joseph, by her testimony, would be this Hebrew slave that did not take me or Potiphar or the position that he had in the household seriously. Exactly the opposite of the truth. Now, there's absolutely no evidence other than her word for an accusation. The cloak of Joseph doesn't really prove anything. This is strictly a power play from a humiliated woman. But if you're an Egyptian slave and you're listening to this, no matter what you've seen and what you've heard and what the gossip that's gone on, no one's going to challenge Potiphar's wife. And if you're really thinking cleverly, you're thinking there may be a position open in the house and I might be next. I'm going to go along to get along. Verse 15, here is her story. When he heard me scream for help, now the word scream in her is her way of setting forth the sexual attack. She has no marks. She has no evidence, which explains verse 16 why she didn't let that cloak out of her sight. And observe the careful interpretation of the narrative. Until his master came home. Do you see that? Observe, it's not her master or her husband. Then verse 17, she tells the story. Now, the Bible teaches that one man tells a story. This is a proverb. One man tells a story and gives an account or a testimony, and then another one comes to question him. Now, we understand that. That's the court system of our government. You always cross-examine a witness. And wisdom's skill in the book of Proverbs is to draw out the truth. Here's another biblical truth. Facts are established by two witnesses, not one. Not just one's testimony. But we're in Egypt, And so what? Verse 17. She uses the word slave, not to the slaves or the servants of the house, but now she uses it to her husband. Because it goes with her claim that he's mocking us. Verse 18, in summary, she portrays herself as virtuous, a victim. She screamed. The cloak is evidence of his identification, and Joseph running away is proof that he's guilty. Verse 19, Potiphar, the text says, burned with anger. But we want to ask, against whom? Notice, the text is ambiguous. Is he angry with Joseph for the attack? Or is he angry because he knows his wife has put him in an impossible situation? Now he must act against a man who has been nothing but an exceptional blessing to his life. Verse 20, he puts him in prison. That, my friends, in Egypt is a mild punishment. An attempted rape in Egypt is a capital offense. Did Potiphar really not believe his wife? We don't know. But the providence of God moves the story forward. He could have easily been killed, but he wasn't. Winston Churchill was captured by the Boers, Dutch farmers in the Transvaal of Africa, when he was a young man. He was put in prison, and what he described as the worst experience of his life. So he and another group of prisoners sought to escape. They determined they would attempt the escape at a latrine. And so came the day. Two groups, well organized, make the escape. The first group went out. They came back to their dismay and reported that the Boer soldiers were all over. Well, Churchill, a self-starter, decided he was going to examine the evidence for himself, maybe to come up with a different plan. So he goes alone to scout out the situation. When he came to the latrine, he saw no Boer guards. One, down the way a bit, had turned his back for a smoke. And Churchill at that moment realized he had a window. So he ran, climbed a wall, and was out. He stole the Dutch clergyman's hat, walked through the main streets of Pretoria, tipping his hat to passersby. He reached the railroad yard, jumped a coal train. He had no idea where it was going. And he left the train in the middle of the night, and he stayed in a swamp. Hungry, dehydrated, he saw lights as he walked down a road. Lights of many houses. He picked out one, went to the front door and knocked. And the man said, "I am the only Englishman within 25 miles. I will hide you until we can make your escape good." He returns to Britain an instant hero. And now you know the rest of the story. Divine providence. He could have been killed, but he wasn't. Verse 20, Joseph's master. Master what? Master by divine providence. Providence, he's preparing him. Preparing him for what? He's preparing him for the next thing. And what was that? That's the prison. Prison under the prosperity and blessing of God. Joseph's circumstances changed, but Joseph doesn't change. He is the tree planted by rivers of water, and he will bear his fruit in season. Have your circumstances changed? Have they changed you? When Paul and Silas were thrown into that prison in Acts chapter 16, what were they doing? Well, At midnight, the scriptures say they were praying and singing hymns to God. They were worshiping. And then what? The next thing, which was an earthquake, which led to the salvation of the jailer and his entire household. Joseph may be in prison, but he doesn't lose his power. The Lord is going to be with him and prosper him no matter what. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in the providence of God. We eat and we drink, daily worship, personal devotion. And when it comes to our employment, he's taught us providence. Providence. And here is the way he framed it for us. Give us this day our daily bread. It doesn't matter if you own 500,000 acres of the Marcellus Shale. Give us this day our daily bread. That is the way we're to live in the providence of God. The world looks at Joseph and calls him a fool. Why, you take what you can get and you move on. And you move on, you get to the top, no matter what, just get there. But this man doesn't. He doesn't weave and he doesn't waver. He walks the straight line of the scriptures, away from the counsel of the ungodly. And so in time, that tree will bear its fruit in season. Let me leave you with three things to ponder from our story today. First, righteousness never promotes. Never. Because we live in a performance-based world. People don't care how many times Tim Tebow stands on the sidelines and goes to one knee and prays. If he does it once a quarter or once a half, they don't care. As long as he's winning, they will keep signs up and billboards up and they will love him. But he better win. It's a performance-based society and world. Jesus Christ went out all alone into the wilderness. And there he met the enemy mano a mano. And he defeated him in that desert. Now we know that because the scriptures teach us that. And they teach us how he defeated him. With the power of the Word of God. And nothing else. The enemy gained no ground and found no place to hide on him. But there was not a great crowd of witnesses. We didn't sell tickets at $1,000 a pop to sit in the stands and watch it. It occurred in obscurity. And your righteousness is here. And it's in obscurity. And the world will never gather around you and lift you up on their shoulders and carry you off the playing field of life because of your righteousness. Second, this man has taught us never to cut a corner. If he's going to get to the top, it's going to be because of God and God only, because God put him there. A few years ago, I'm teaching a Friday morning Bible study with a group of businessmen. It's been one of the richest blessings of my life. And a few years ago, I taught on the life of David from beginning to end. And it took me several years to get through it. And we come to One of the great crescendos of David's life, it occurs in 2 Samuel 5. You read the narrative and it just, you read through it so fast you don't even catch the significance. But it is the mountaintop. It says, then all the elders of Israel, they came from all the tribes, they gathered together at Hebron and they anointed David king. There he had been 15 years on the back of every milk carton in Israel. In every post office, his picture, his description. And now he's king. And I ask the question to these businessmen, what did David do to get there? And the answer is absolutely nothing. He could have killed Saul, his mortal enemy, could have killed him twice. Had him alone, man on man, could have killed him. He could have given the order, Abishai could have killed him. But he doesn't. He lets him live so that he can tomorrow go hunt David down again and become his enemy all fresh again. And what did he do with Ishbosheth, which was Saul's grandson and heir to the throne? He does nothing. Well, surely when Saul died, he consolidated his power together and he rode up to Jerusalem. No, because Jerusalem wasn't there. He was at Hebron in Judah because God told him, you go to Hebron in Judah and you sit there. And he did. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, Hebron in Judah. And then the day came. And they said, you're the only ace in the deck. You're king. Third, he goes in this story from promotion to demotion. And you read the story and you, I can't connect the dots. Well, what's really happening here? Got a call from a guy out of state this past week. He said, I just need to talk. I just lost $1.5 million account. That's a stable account for us, my group. We did nothing to lose that account. We did nothing. We got sabotaged. We got blindsided. Whatever. It's gone. I just needed to talk to you. And, boy, this guy is so important to me. Such a blessing in my life. You know, Will Rogers says, you can't have a parade unless somebody stands on the curb and claps. And I just stand on the curb and clap for this guy all the time. What do you do? He's hurting. Remind him of the sovereignty of God. Remind him of the providence of God. He could tell me as much about them as I know. And I said to him, I just can't connect the dots. I can't for you. I can't for me. I can't for anybody. I don't know why it's happening. I don't know why you suddenly have a brain tumor. I sat on the edge of a bed 3 years ago in August. One of the guys that I've had a big ministry in his life had an inoperable brain tumor. We knew it was terminal. We just didn't know how long. And he looked at me with a sober face and he said, this is God's will for my life. I said, you're ready for the next thing. And you're going to see it like Nobody's seen it. I don't know what he was doing with Joseph. Yeah, I read the Joseph epic, and sure, the whole thing fits together. It's a magnificent puzzle. But right here, we're just looking at a piece, and I can't fit it into the picture, and I don't know where it belongs on the mural. And that's where we live. That's where you live and I live. I can't connect the dots. I don't know where the piece fits. So I pray for you, and I cry for you, and I hold your hand, put my arm around you, and then I end it this way. All things are working together for the good. They are. You know why? Because I've read Joseph. I've read Joseph. And I don't care how dark it gets, he's going to get there. And he's going to rule it all. He's going to reconcile the family. And he's going to put them in a safe environment to live for 400 years. And God's program is going to go forward. And that's what he's doing with you. And that's what he's doing with me. Study this man, and you'll see your life, and it'll change your life. Let's pray. Thank you for his courage, for his strength. Thank you that he taught us in a way that we could never teach ourselves. He's alone. He's in a foreign land. He's just been promoted. He's got all the powers of darkness set against him. And he goes to prison. And it doesn't make any sense at all. But it is your plan and your purpose. And we know this, that in those hours of darkness and sadness, you're making the man, because he would never be able to rule Egypt and never be able to be handed the keys to that kingdom except he suffer and go through what he went through. Lord, that's why we're here. That's why we're in this text this morning. And that is our lives. And we say it together in the powerful name of Jesus Christ. Amen.